University of Colorado.
Thanks for tuning in to See You on the Air, the podcast of the University of Colorado. Today we welcome Stan Sucher, Associate Professor of Music and Entertainment Industry Studies at the University of Colorado, Denver.
The music industry was never simple. As time has gone on, particularly in the digital media era, it's gotten so complicated. We really need to look at these important key cases and see what we can learn and how those some of those mistakes can be avoided, and if not, how they might be worked out.
He's also an entertainment attorney, the longtime editor-in-chief of Entertainment Law and Finance, and the author of two investigative books, They Fought the Law, Rock Music Goes to Court, and Baby, You're a Rich Man, Suing the Beatles for Fun and Profit.
Well, I'll tell you as a disclaimer going in, I'm a big Beatles fan, so I'm pretty interested in that, but I know we want to talk about some more things than that. Maybe we could start out. You could tell us a little bit about how you got interested in entertainment law.
It's great to have a career where one thing leads to another that is of interest to you, that we have a lot of enthusiasm. So I was always very deeply into music from the start, when first grade, when my grandfather bought me a guitar that I couldn't play, but I could lip sync to Elvis records. So I started getting invited to parties to do that. So always into music, and then I always wanted to be a writer, so since I was about five, but always thought it would be fiction, something like that. And then, you know, as a teenager, I became in a rock band as a drummer. I grew up in Florida. I moved to New York City to see what I could do as to writing about music. And I ended up in a magazine at that time, you know, pre-internet. There wasn't actually a lot of national music press. There was Rolling Stone, which had moved to New York City around that time. But I ended up in a magazine. It was really a fanzine named Circus Magazine.
Yeah, I was
one of the editors there. So we did, you know, we interviewed quite a broad range of artists, even though we were considered a rock fanzine. So I would do an interview maybe with Carly Simon, the Bee Gees, you know, Yvonne Elliman, who had If I Can't Have You as a number one hit at Saturday Night Fever, many of those kinds of artists, but also a lot of outrageous artists. So back then, like David Lee Roth of Van Halen, interviewing people like that, they would say a lot of outrageous things, like David Lee Roth. And I wasn't sure what I could use as a writer. I wasn't even sure about the copyrights in the stories I wrote. I was working for the magazine as a full-time employee, but who really owned the rights in the stories that I was writing? So I was very interested in finding out about the legal rights of writers, which I ended up in law school. So with that background, it all seemed to come together, law, music, and writing. So that's what I pursued. I became a member of the New York Bar, did that, representing artists and doing other kinds of legal work, and also entertainment law journalist, which has been a blast because entertainment law is an area that covers a lot of issues, a lot of areas, contracts, right of publicity, trademarks, royalties, you name it. Today, digital media law, all those rights, music streaming, those are being carved out by courts all the time. I was able to get all this and put it into one. And really, that's a kind of a long way of saying that's how I became so interested in entertainment law.
And back then when you were interviewing some of those musicians, performers, you didn't have much an idea about copyright. Did you find they had any inkling about it?
Well, artists have a long history, particularly in the early years of the modern music age, which generally you would say starts with rock and roll in the mid-50s, where the music industry starts to become somewhat more sophisticated and gets more sophisticated over time. So artists didn't have a lot of sources of information in those earlier years. And when I was doing it late 70s into the 80s, you know, doing a lot of music journalism, and then also interviewing artists later as an entertainment law journalist, I discovered they usually weren't that sophisticated, but also they had to deal with the issue of unequal bargaining power as they were getting their careers off the ground, the contracts they signed. When you put those two things together, a lack of legal sophistication with the bargaining power on the other side, the record company, a manager who drafts a contract and hands it to an artist to sign, the odds against staying a successful artist and making sure that your finances and legal rights are in order is really quite a challenge. Was then, actually still is today, but the major difference is today is a lot more information out there. I mean, for instance, when I started in the industry, we didn't have music business programs like we have at CU Denver. That's the one that I teach in here. I teach law in the music industry. International music business is an area we're moving in, where digital media law that I mentioned.
And so the old stereotype of the artist being exploited by the managers or record company was more often than not true.
Very true. And lots of litigation, particularly with major artists. Once they become really successful, the stakes get a lot higher. And then when they look at those earlier contracts and they have a solid legal counsel to advise them when they can do that later in their careers, the questions come up, you know, what do those earlier contracts mean to me today? A lot of times artists will try to break out of those contracts. There's quite a bit of litigation that's occurred over that. And certainly most major artists experience that.
Speaking of major artists, you've written a book, you've written a couple of books, but Baby, You're a Rich Man, Suing the Beatles for Fun and Profit. The Beatles were a lightning rod for a lot of lawsuits. And I think here is a prototypical story of four lads from Liverpool who all of a sudden are the biggest thing in the world. And that seems like that was the moment where some of their legal problems started.
They are, actually, I'd have to use the word excellent only in a descriptive way, not in a qualifying way for them.
But no, I think you can use it that
but
way.
But they, their music's certainly excellent. Their first manager, Brian Epstein, had no management experience. Of course, he was from Liverpool like the Beatles. He was in the record retail business. He was very successful at that. He was the largest record retail account in that part of Northwest England. But when he saw the Beatles at the Cavern Club and signed them, he really didn't know much about the industry beyond record retailing. So that led to a lot of issues for the Beatles right away, particularly because once they signed with him, it wasn't that much longer after that that Beatlemania happened, that they really hit it big. You know, he signs them in 1962 as a manager, and in 1963 they have three number one hits in England: "Please Please Me," "From Me to You," and "She Loves You." And by the end of that year, in October, they do a show in London where the fans are outside going wild over them, and the press the very next day coins the phrase, the British press, "Beatlemania." So you can imagine. That gets the attention out of a lot of so-called industry sharks. What have we got here? Let's take a look at the Beatles. And so they did indeed end up all through the years in lots of different legal disputes and legal challenges that have really are really cautionary tales even today for artists, especially because the Beatles were the first internationally branded band. And today, with record sales have gone down, music streaming's coming up, but it's really micro pennies for artists per stream. So it's all about the larger picture of the artist's brand, the ancillary revenues, the merchandising, all kinds of areas that the artists tap into. The Beatles were doing a lot of those things with their merchandising deals, big legal disputes over that.
So Beatles lunchbox, Beatles
lunchbox. The first big dispute in the U.S. was over Beatles dolls. They came over, of course, in 1964 to be on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 64. They had their first number one hit, "And I Want to Hold Your Hand," in early 64. And they signed a deal with an exclusive licensor for Beatles dolls, for all kinds of things. But there was a lot of pirated goods out there. So they went to court for that. And it's interesting because in the research I did for the book, I did as much archival research. I did interviews for the book, of course, but a lot of archival research in court documents. And one of them was that Beatles dolls case, which was in a Brooklyn federal court. I found the original transcript of the hearing with the judge, not a computer printout back then from 1964. It was on onion skin paper typed. Transcript. you know, the Beatles were saying, we want to get an injunction against a company in Brooklyn that's about to start distributing. They're developing Beatle-like dolls. They're really trying to parlay off of us. The judge was very cynical about the Beatles and their lasting value. So, and it shows up a lot in the transcript that he says, you know, when they were on Ed Sullivan, of course, the fans in the audience are screaming and going wild. And the judge, and I'm reading the transcript, he's saying that, well, it must be that somebody was holding up a sign off the side of the camera that said, scream now. There could be no way that, you know, that this particular group could get that kind of response otherwise.
Little did he know, they didn't need that to be scripted.
Right, right. It was pretty spontaneous.
Fast forwarding a bit, a common perception is the Beatles broke up because of Yoko Ono. But I think at that point, toward the end, there were many lawsuits between each other and among management. And I would suggest that as much as anything, along with typical pressures, led to their breakup.
And it's true, there were multiple elements. They stopped touring in 1966, spending a lot of time in the studio. But John Lennon, who was the founder, really the founder of the band, was starting to drift away. He had issues to deal with. And Paul was starting to step up more as the member of the band that kept it going. It was around this time that John and Yoko got together. And you know, Yoko was coming to the studio. That was something that the Beatles, you know, they had a few friends in, and George Martin, of course, the producer and the recording engineers. But having a significant other of who Yoko was at that time, John and Yoko weren't married, in the studio a lot, really was starting to throw the Beatles off. But when I did my research, and what I was looking at was the legal perspective again, it's fairly clear, Ken, that when the end of the Beatles came, you know, Paul sued the others in December 1970. The other three. And his goal was to break up the Beatles' band partnership. The band partnership, not all of their, not Apple Corps, their larger company, but the band. And the reason was, that from the court documents, was the last manager, Alan Klein. John Lennon thought Alan Klein was great because Alan Klein had managed the Rolling Stones. He had managed the great soul artist Sam Cooke. And Alan Klein had gotten the Rolling Stones a $1 million advance when Alan renegotiated the Rolling Stones deal with Decca Records. Brian Epstein, when he renegotiated the Beatles deal with Capital EMI Records, the Beatles label, he did not get them in advance. So John Lennon knew this. And Brian, by the way, passed away in August of 1967. So they needed a manager, and they were floundering at Apple Corps. So they needed help. And Alan Klein already had his sights on them a number of years previously when Brian was alive. In fact, when the Beatles were doing one of their summer tours in the mid-60s in the U.S. while they were planning it, Alan Klein talked to Brian Epstein about the possibility of Sam Cooke being the opening act for the Beatles, which would have been an incredible tour.
I'd have seen that show.
Yeah, just incredible. But that didn't work out. And so when he came in, Paul resisted that, did not like him, did not trust him, and did file that lawsuit in the end of 1970 to dissolve the band's partnership and to have a financial receiver appointed to watch over the Beatles' money as it came in.
How much did all of the lawsuits with the Beatles impact their music?
You know, that really goes to the heart of, you know, the term music law, music and law. So that's a great question, and it did impact them, particularly George Harrison. It took them another 5 years to negotiate the settlement of dissolving the band partnership. But of the four Beatles, in terms of legal issues, it's, you know, John had the immigration battle when he wanted to stay in the United States, which he won. He wanted to become a permanent resident, moved to New York, John Lennon. But George faced the My Sweet Lord copyright infringement case in the 1970s. He faced, after Alan Klein, additional management disputes right up till the end of his life. And he said more than one time, George, that it's really impacting my ability to write songs. In fact, his first wife, Patty Boyd, said, you know, when George was sued over My Sweet Lord by the publishers of the Chiffons' early 60s hit He's So Fine, Patty said that George just stopped listening to the radio. He was too worried about it. So it did have an impact.
As I recall, He was found liable for that, but he subconsciously plagiarized, was the ruling?
Yes, and the judge, Judge Richard Owen, who was an opera composer and had some of his operas publicly performed, it was a bench trial, so there was no jury. It was this judge. But he did find that George subconsciously infringed, which really says that it wasn't intentional, and that somehow, because the Chiffon Tea So Fine was on the charts in England in 1962 into early 63, around there, at the same time that the Beatles' first hit, Love Me Do, was on the English charts. So Judge Owen said, you know, somehow the Chiffon song was in George's mind. And so that is how the subconscious infringement ruling came about.
And that seems like such a tough ruling, because I would suggest that most musicians would clearly talk about the people who influenced them, so it would follow that the music is somewhere there in their subconscious or closer to the surface.
It's true. It's you know, in copyright infringement cases are taken. It's a case-by-case basis. There's no bright line that says this in every case. It's always the same. When you reach this point, it's an infringement. So what you're talking about here, Ken, is when does influence, does it become infringement at some point? Because the influence is so strong.
Of all of the lawsuits that the Beatles were involved in from the early days up past, well past the breakup, was anyone more significant than all the others?
Of the lawsuits, well, there are a number of, you know, the My Sweet Lord suit was the most famous copyright infringement suit up until recent years. There are other cases, so it's hard to choose just one with the Beatles, but they hit music royalties, infringement, management issues, lots of different hot button issues in music law.
This book and your other book, it seems like a common commentary or in reviews, is it that it's a cautionary tale. So how would you describe the cautionary tale?
And this is something that goes to the, you know, the music business courses that I'm teaching at CU Denver. We always talk about that. Lessons to be learned, always looking at the fact pattern, you know, how did the issue come up? The music industry was never simple. As time has gone on, particularly in the digital media era, it's gotten so complicated. We really need to look at these important key cases and see what we can learn and how some of those mistakes can be avoided, and if not, how they might be worked out.
Your other book was They Fought the Law, Rock Music Goes to Court. What are some of the cases you cover in that book?
Yeah, well, that I think was some 9 chapters, and it covered landmark cases and major artists involved in landmark cases. So the first chapter was about Elvis Presley. It went into the management issues, the financial issues, his estate's battle over the right of publicity, also like the Beatles, having to deal with a lot of unauthorized merchandise, particularly as soon as Elvis passed away in August of 1977. The right of publicity law was very unclear. And so the estate won some and they lost some. So that was that. Another was Billy Joel. Billy Joel's dispute with his former manager and the brother of his ex-wife. So it was like...
makes interesting Thanksgiving dinners, I'd imagine.
Yeah. They had a lot to talk about over dinner. Then all the way up to the Supreme Court. So there was a case involving the rap group, the 2 Live Crew. And it was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court in November of 1993. I covered this for Rolling Stone and for a publication I still edit named Entertainment Law and Finance. It's a monthly publication that I've been editing for a long time. And that case involved the 2 Live Crews. What they said was a rap parody of Roy Orbison's classic 1964 rock hit, Oh Pretty Woman. And that was the first time the U.S. Supreme Court ever ruled that a parody may be a copyright fair use.
Weird Al thanks you for that. So here in Denver in 1994, a jury ruled that Michael Jackson didn't steal his hit song Dangerous from a local songwriter, and you have some interest in that case?
Yes, that's also a complete chapter in They Fought the Law. So did a lot of interviews, it's very interesting because, of course, Michael Jackson is the level of success he was at. He was a deep pocket defendant. So it wasn't uncommon for him to be sued by people. And
With copyright infringement, the case you're talking about, The Dangerous, Crystal Cartier was an artist here who's from Denver who claimed that her song Dangerous had been infringed by Michael Jackson's song Dangerous, even though song titles are not copyrightable. But she said, well, it's substantially similar, which is the key copyright infringement test, Michael Jackson's song to mine. So she sued him. But what's interesting is, and lost, he did win in front of the jury, is that Michael Jackson on some of his songs was sued by totally different people saying, you stole that song from me. And it'd be the same song, a different lawsuit, someone else saying, no, you stole that song from me. So it's, you know, one of the interesting things for attorneys who represent artists is to, you know, how do you figure all this out? Well, it's easy to say if there is any infringement at all, and the attorney's going to say there isn't. But if there would be, it can't be all these different plaintiffs at the same time.
I want to back up a little bit. You were talking about Elvis's estate, and there was something in the media just recently. I think his daughter said the estate is swimming in red ink.
It's an interesting story because celebrity estates have really, you know, the brand lasts. We were talking a little while ago about the brand and how important that is for the artist today. So Elvis's estate, you know, it's been up and down would be the answer. They struggled. One of the things I did when I did They Fought the Law is I went to the probate court to look at some of the documents there, and I discovered that he had five bank accounts. One was for $1 million. That was to pay taxes. But three of them had, like, one of them around $39 in it. When he died, he was essentially broke. And I also learned that he had Graceland on a revolving mortgage. So he would get the mortgage in the bank. He would go out on a tour. Then he would earn the money and pay that off, and then he would do it again because he had a high living lifestyle and just didn't care if he spent the money, but then that put him in debt. So when Graceland started, you know, after the first years, it started doing really well. In fact, Lisa Marie, who's the sole heir of Elvis, Elvis had divorced Priscilla before he passed away, and Lisa Marie sold a large percentage of her interest in the Elvis rights. I believe she still owns the Graceland property. So again, when they go up and down, they had the last Elvis week had, was it something like 50,000 people showed up last August? It was the 40th anniversary of his passing.
You touched on this a little bit, but I'll ask you to expand. Entertainment law is complex to begin with. Is it more complex in the digital age?
Yes, because there are a lot of rights still being carved out. We get a lot of digital media rulings, digital media content. Of course, some of the early legal issues was when unauthorized file sharing really took off, and that's back around 2000 that began, and then the record labels, which were really at a peak with record sales. We know, it's well known that record sales started dropping significantly. And then the record labels started going after the tech companies that were developing the file sharing software. But they also started going after their own, let's say, potential consumers when they started suing people who were at home downloading music from the internet. The record companies filed approximately 35,000 lawsuits. And one interesting thing, I came to the University of Colorado Denver in 2000. That's when I began. Originally as music department chair, that's how I was originally hired. Then also teaching music business courses and sometimes history of rock and roll. But at that time, the Record Industry Association of America, their lead counsel law firm on those lawsuits was based here in Denver. In fact, the lead counsel for them, Richard Gabriel, who I interviewed at that time and had interviewed, he was involved in the Crystal Cartier case on the defense side and is now on the a justice on the Colorado Supreme Court. That's where the record industry had their focal point of those lawsuits actually was in Denver. But a lot of those downloading potential consumers defaulted, wouldn't be able to afford to pay big damages anyways, and that's when the industry kept its focus on the tech companies, which is how it's been pretty much since then.
Interesting. You talked about the parable of the managers or the record companies preying on impressionable artists, and particularly early in their career. Do you find that artists today have learned some of those lessons, or is that kind of thing still prevalent?
The information is now there. There's a lot more sources out there for artists. there are a lot more books, a lot more internet sites, a lot more attorneys practicing in the music law area or the entertainment law area. But it still gets down to bargaining power, like any negotiation. So for newer artists, they don't have the bargaining power yet. For the more successful artists, they are able to get savvy entertainment attorneys because it's a much larger industry now than it was then. I mean, the entertainment industry, the music industry has been struggling with the file sharing issue in terms of revenues. But if an artist is motivated and wants to be a self-learner, it's really great to get out there and look at all that information that's out there, kind of get yourself briefed on it, so to speak. And then when you get with a seasoned entertainment attorney, you'll be able to spot the issues, ask the questions, have some sense of what the lawyer is talking about. So I would say an artist is in a better position today in terms, again, of the information flow.
The old sign hair days are hopefully a thing of the past for artists. Another Denver case, a jury ruled against a local DJ here, sued Taylor Swift after she accused him of groping her. Any surprises about that case?
The legal issue was very straightforward. The evidence was straightforward with the backstage photo of the former DJ touching Taylor Swift. And what she said, what they ruled was sexual assault. So from a legal perspective, it was a fairly straightforward case. But, you know, she made a statement, I'm only asking for a dollar in damages. And it's not that long ago in terms of the Me Too movement. There she was last year in one of the cover of Time magazine with one of the people of the year. So it was a statement case that really is part of this trend and is a key part of this trend, really brought a lot of attention to what became the Me Too movement and the issue of sexual harassment in the entertainment industry.
Yeah, interesting. What are some of the courses that you teach in your program?
So law in the music industry, you know, Ken, as you've been asking me questions, we cover a lot of these topics, though it's one that is a challenge because I always say to the music law students in our music business program at CU Denver, every semester as we begin, we'll be talking about cases during the semester on key legal issues that haven't even been decided yet. And that's true. So that's one. The international music business, we do a music business senior seminar where a component is international music business. The music streaming, as music streaming is becoming more popular, because it's micro pennies for artists, just one stream, the only way it's going to be significant for record labels and the industry itself is a volume business. And there are a lot of countries around the world that didn't have really much of a brick and mortar record industry. When physical product was really thriving. But a lot of these countries are getting digitally wired. And some of the countries, like China, has had a long history of a lot of piracy. But now what we've seen is record companies and movie companies and others entering into streaming licensing agreements in countries like China, which creates a really great opportunity for the industry. We talk about that in the international music business component of the senior seminar.
And what kind of careers do your students pursue?
Well, they've ended up in a lot of different areas of the industry. Of course, we have two general populations of students. There's the artist and, you know, singer-songwriters, musicians and singers who take some of our classes. And then we have those who want to work at the companies, so want to work at management companies, want to work at music publishing companies. And really, we provide information for both of those general populations. So a lot of our students have ended up in a successful artist and also successful at a lot of the entertainment industry companies.
Going back to the Beatles a little bit, if George Martin had let you in one of those recording sessions in 1962 and you could give them a bit of advice, knowing what you know, what would that advice be?
I'm assuming you're saying legal advice because, yep. You know, there'd be a great desire to kind of chime in on the music and they wouldn't like that. Now, of course, I just want to say I am a drummer, so I'd be tempted to say, Ringo, could I kind of just play something on that record? Can I just do one track on Rubber Soul, you know? Which, of course, would be no.
They'd say no. Go over there and sit with Pete Best.
I think that if we could bring the information we have today to them, I would urge them to become as educated about the issues as possible. One of the problems with Brian Epstein is when they negotiated their merchandising deal in England with a company of people who had no previous merchandising experience, Brian Epstein said, I've got to find somebody to do the Beatles merchandise to kind of be the licensor for us, exclusive worldwide. They went to a show business lawyer in London named David Jacobs, and he had represented some old school artists like a great actress, Marlene Dietrich, and others, but was not really a rock and roll modern music industry lawyer. And so he and Brian negotiated a very poor merchandising deal for the Beatles, where the company that they signed with and gave exclusive worldwide rights and had no prior experience with merchandising, it was founded by somebody who had run a club in London, which is important, but had nothing to do with the merchandising. Brian and David Jacobs gave that company 90%. They said, you can have 90% of the income that comes in from the Beatles merchandising. So
wow.
I think if I had one thing to say to the Beatles, it would be stay away from attorneys that don't know about your business. And make better choices on that, because this is your starting point. You don't know where this is going. If we looked at it from early 63, let's say, or somewhere in 1963, give that a lot of consideration. Get the best counsel possible. Paul McCartney is an example of an artist who he wanted to know things. It mattered to him. So, and he had good legal advice as the years went on. John Lennon, on the other hand, was an artist who said, you know, when the royalty statements came in, I didn't pay much attention to them. It wasn't that important to me. So a lot of it has to do with right in the same band, you had two different perspectives as to is there a necessary learning curve on music law or not. But again, I think that's the best starting point is get with somebody who knows the legal issues and can give you the best advice.
And at one point, they lost the publishing rights to their songs, but then reclaimed them?
Well, what happened is once they had a couple of hits, there was a publisher named Dick James, who was a well-known music publisher in London, that I believe George Martin introduced the band to them. And they formed Northern Song specifically to house the Lennon-McCartney song catalog. And then George also signed with Northern Songs. So the Beatles did have a share of Northern Songs. They did have a share of the company. They never had a majority stake, however. Before I go on, I should make it clear that there's the publishing rights in songs and the songwriter's share. So Lennon and McCartney kept the songwriting share, and they've always had that. But when it came to the publishing, because the publishers usually get the copyright in the songs and then pay the songwriters. So later in the 1960s, there was a company, ATV was the name, and they were a large entertainment conglomerate. And they did, you know, TV shows. I believe it was like Secret Agent Man might have been one of their shows, but The Saint with Roger Moore definitely was. Sir Lou Grade was an entertainment industry empresario who ran that company. They wanted to get Northern Song. So there was a very public bidding war that went on where Lennon and McCartney and the Beatles tried to cobble together a majority stake in the publishing company and thereby being able to take over the company. They lost that battle. It was in the 1980s when ATV, after they did their version of the Titanic, which didn't do well, a movie, they decided we need money and they put Northern Songs up for sale. And that is the most famous story of all, because that's when Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney worked together on the Thriller album on The Girl Is Mine. And that's when Paul said, you know, that's a classic story. He said, well, and I point out to Michael, well, you know, music publishing is very important. And when ATV went up for sale, Michael Jackson had the money to buy the Beatles song catalog, publishing rights. McCartney didn't. He tried to put something together with Yoko and they didn't get it. So recently, and I don't want to get, you know, overly technical, but it's just in the last year or so that Paul McCartney, under U.S. law, for the U.S. share of his Beatles songs copyrights, sent a copyright termination notice to ATV, a Sony ATV today, all simply stated a U.S. copyright law allows a creator who assigns their copyright to another company to recapture it after a certain amount of years. Paul tried to do that by suing Sony ATV a little over a year ago in New York federal court. They ended up settling that case. But that is a brief history of the rights in the Beatles songs.
Interesting. You talked about your interest in entertainment law, kind of starting with the rock and roll era and coming right up through the digital age. As you look on the horizon, what do you see?
One of the issues, I think, the hologram tours. I mean, at the Super Bowl, we saw the controversial Justin Timberlake performance where he had a Prince hologram, and some people like that, and some fans just don't want to see that. But I think, for instance, there's been announced a hologram tour of Frank Zappa. There can be an Elvis Presley hologram tour. Elvis never toured worldwide. So I think, what are the rights? You know, how do you divvy up the rights? There's rights of publicity in that. That's very cutting edge. How do you put on a world tour with a hologram? What are the range of rights there? The digital rights and other rights. So I think, though, a straight-ahead way to answer would be, I think we're going to continue down that path of courts carving out legal principles as to digital media content.
When you were working at Circus, were there any artists that you interviewed who you thought were particularly savvy about entertainment, the business, the law of it?
I wasn't so focused on that then. I thought, at least first in terms of the music, Pete Townsend was an artist who I interviewed him a long time ago now when the Who Are You album came out. So I interviewed him, and he was extremely serious about what his music meant. I thought that, wow. So he might have been somebody who might have been able to handle studying legal issues. And by the way, that while I was interviewing Pete, Keith Moon, the drummer, knock on the door, and it's Keith, and I'm a drummer, and he's like almost my favorite drummer, comes into the room, did a on-the-spot interview. He unfortunately passed away 4 weeks later. I did one of the last interviews with him, but he was somebody who was not as grounded as Pete. So I think within the same band, like with the Beatles, like John Lennon and Paul McCartney, you can get two different types of personalities where I think Pete's seriousness would have lent himself to that. A very interesting interview of all things was with Gladys Knight. I was doing an article for a magazine in the 1980s named Musician Magazine. It was about legal structures, artist business organization. And she went through how they had the business structure of Gladys Knight and the Pips set up. It was very interesting, and she was very clear about it. There have been a few former artists who have gone to law school. That's always very interesting. I know there's a former member of Sha Na Na, which was like an oldies retro band that appeared at Woodstock just before Jimi Hendrix, who went to law school. And there's a few others. A former member of Country Joe and the Fish, which is a psychedelic rock group in the 60s, also went to law school. So some of those artists do end up in the legal field as professionals.
You taught the history of rock and roll, so the old question, if you were stranded on a desert island with one album to listen to forever, what would it be?
Well, you know, that's always a tough question. I love the Beatles. I'm going to say one of their albums, but I will say that I always loved the harmonies of a British invasion band named the Hollies. Bus Stop, Graham Nash was in that band. I just think they were superb. And they were produced by Ron Richards, who had worked with George Martin in the Beatles' early years. When the Beatles first came to record, Ron Richards was the assistant engineer at that time. But I think if it's an album, it's Rubber Soul. It's always been my favorite Beatles album because it's a turning point. It's a folk rock album, really. It's got a Dylan influence, but it's very straight ahead. And it's got a lot of humanity to it. It's a very real feeling when you hear the lyric. Ringo's drums are very straight ahead. You know, he's criticized a lot for his drumming. He's too basic, but that's really not true because he really added a lot of this straight ahead simplicity to the Beatles, which really shines on Rubber Soul. Because that's just before that, Revolver, which is another great album, but it's much more studio technology once they stop touring. So I would say it's Rubber Soul.
Okay. Well, Stan Sutcher, we appreciate your insight into a really fascinating slice of something that touches us all, music.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for interviewing me. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for CU on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises four campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.